International News.
Today is Tuesday, April 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The half-brother of Jordan's King Abdullah says that he will not comply after being told to keep quiet by the army.
Jordan's government says that the former heir to the throne has been involved in a plot that would have disrupted the country's security.
Plus, what are the regional implications as the United States and Iran hold indirect talks Tuesday? And the story of African bamboo bikes making a big impression on the world stage. We'll have these stories and more next. In Jordan, the half-brother of King Abdullah and the former heir to the throne says in a recording released by the country's opposition that he will not comply with an order by the army to keep quiet. Reuters' Maha Al-Bitrawi is up first.
Jordan's estranged Prince Hamza released a voice recording on Monday in which he says he would defy orders by the army not to communicate with the outside world after he was put under house arrest and accused of trying to destabilize the country. In the recording, he said, quote, "For sure I won't obey when they tell you that you cannot go out or tweet or reach out to people, but are only allowed to see the family." He added that the chief of staff spoke to him and that he recorded the conversation, quote, "in case something happens." Jordan's government says that the former heir to the throne has been involved in a plot that would have disrupted the country's security. The alleged plot is said to involve an unnamed intelligence agency, and several high-profile figures have been detained. He vehemently denied involvement in a video statement given to the BBC and accused Jordan's leaders of corruption in an apparent attempt to tap into the public's frustrations. Prince Hamza was removed from his position as heir to the throne in 2004 by his half-brother King Abdullah in a move that consolidated the king's power. His actions suggest he is keen to shore up his position with ordinary Jordanians after he was removed from the royal succession. The intrigue is likely to shake Jordan's image as a haven of stability in the Middle East.
Reuters reporter Maha Al-Bitrawi. Hundreds of civilians in Myanmar, including activists, members of former de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy Party, and villagers in ethnic areas being bombed by the army, have gone into hiding. Some are seeking refuge in Kayin State opposite Thailand. It's a region controlled by the Karen National Union, an ethnic arm organization that is no stranger to conflict, having been fighting for greater autonomy in Myanmar for more than seven decades. Steve Sanford has the details.
Here in Maysot, signs of increased security can be seen along the border as the conflict escalates across the river in Myanmar's Kayin State. Thousands of civilians have gone into hiding as government forces continue a brutal crackdown on the civilian population, including indiscriminate air attacks. For some migrants, like this former Karen soldier whose working wife is stranded in Yangon with two children, the daily updates from home are distressing.
My family is in danger. Outside our apartment building, the Burmese authorities watch us and use slingshots to smash windows on the building. And they arrest people because the Burmese authorities don't want them to resist.
Some exiles, like Miatu, a former member of the All Burma Students Democratic Front, fled the country after the 1988 uprising, when the military cracked down on anti-government demonstrations, killing hundreds of protesters. It has been 30 years since Miatu took up arms with ethnic armies in Kayin State, but the former activist still volunteers advice to all who face persecution by the coup leaders.
I suggest those people in danger to contact nearest ethnic arms groups, which I think is very, very safe for them to hide at the moment.
Despite international condemnation, Myanmar's forces continue brutal attacks on unarmed civilians as the death toll mounts. That's why the Karen National Union is getting set to provide sanctuary for fleeing Myanmar citizens of all ethnic nationalities.
We have prepared the land to accommodate the people who are fleeing to a safe place in our Karen area, more than 400 acres of Myanmar exiles.
As the Myanmar army continues a vicious crackdown on civilians, the number of those fleeing to the border is expected to rise. Steve Sanford for VOA News, Maysat, Thailand.
Top European officials head to Turkey Tuesday to meet with President Recep Tayyip Erdogan in a bid to reset relations. Dorian Jones has that story.
In a bid to ease the latest tensions, European Council President Charles Michel and European Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen will seek a framework for cooperation with Turkey when they meet President Recep Tayyip Erdogan Tuesday. The EU wants to continue a 2016 refugee agreement that turned Turkey into Europe's gatekeeper for migrants and refugees. Analyst Sinan Ülgen of the İDAM research organization in Istanbul says Ankara is ready for a deal at a price.
The Turkish government seems to want to extend this deal, provided that the EU sets up a funding mechanism that is similar to the financial package of years past. And also the EU will give the go-ahead to the start of the negotiations for the modernization of the customs union, and also vitalization of the visa liberalization process.
Michel and von der Leyen will be conveying to Erdogan the message of last month's EU summit that any concessions will be tied to Turkey's continuing talks with EU member Greece. The talks aim to resolve territorial disputes over the dividing Aegean and Mediterranean seas, which are believed to have significant energy reserves. Analyst Aslı Aydıntaşbaş says despite the Turkish-Greek talks, the situation remains volatile.
While we have had the start of Turkish-Greek talks that were meant for de-escalation, it is really ripe for tensions because you still do not have any solution to some of the underlying issues in the Aegean.
But Turkey's human rights record is not expected to be high on the agenda of Tuesday's discussions. Last month, Ankara pulled out of a critical convention to protect women, and prosecutors opened a closure case against Turkey's second-largest opposition party, the pro-Kurdish HDP. But Emma Sinclair Webb of the New York-based Human Rights Watch fears pragmatism is usurping principle, and her group is calling on the European Union not to ignore human rights issues.
I think Ankara believes they can get away with anything at the moment, but I do think it's really time for the EU to start to speak with a much tougher language to Ankara and to answer back. The EU looks weak by constantly trying to put a positive spin on developments that are unconscionable.
With Turkey hosting about 4 million Syrian refugees, analysts say the priority of EU leaders' Tuesday meeting with Erdogan will likely be to ensure Turkey's ongoing role as refugee gatekeeper and avoid tensions with Greece. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
Israeli prosecutors are accusing Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of trading favors like currency at the opening of a corruption trial, which, along with an inconclusive election, has clouded his prospects of remaining in office. Reuters reporter Emily Wither.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's legal and political troubles played out in parallel on Monday at his corruption trial and in the president's residence. Netanyahu appeared at a Jerusalem district court at the start of a corruption trial. The prime minister has pleaded not guilty to charges of bribery, breach of trust, and fraud. His appearance comes as Israel's president, Reuven Rivlin, began consulting with party heads on who might form the next coalition government. A toss-up after the March 23 election, the fourth in 2 years, gave neither Netanyahu nor his rivals a clear mandate. Rivlin said ethical considerations could factor into his decision, apparently alluding to Netanyahu's trial. During the consultation sessions, the Israeli president met with Likud party representatives and their rivals, Yesh Atid. Rivlin warned Israel could be dragged into a fifth election. Back at the court, Israeli protesters labeled Netanyahu prime minister. The state said Netanyahu was responsible for regulations that allowed a telecom power couple to clinch deals worth many hundreds of millions of shekels in exchange for them sweetening coverage of the premier on a popular news site then under their control. Prosecutor Liat Ben Ari told the court the relationship between Netanyahu and the co-defendants became currency, something that could be traded. The leader faces two additional cases in what is the first criminal trial of a sitting Israeli prime minister. He describes himself as the victim of a politically motivated witch hunt.
Emily Wither reports for Reuters News. You're listening to International Edition. On the Voice of America, I'm Steve Miller. Iran and the United States will hold indirect talks in Vienna Tuesday as part of broader negotiations to revive the 2015 nuclear deal between Tehran and global powers. The two sides will not meet face-to-face, but Washington has called the meeting a healthy step forward and aims to set the groundwork to bring all sides back into compliance with the landmark deal. But what's at stake given that these are indirect talks? For that, I spoke with Rupal Mehta, associate political science professor at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
I think the stakes are pretty low to medium. I mean, I think this is just a foray back into conversations between the two countries to see if there are, really not even between the two countries, right? These are between intermediaries to see if there's any future for the JCPOA. My sense is that Iran is going to be observing the behavior of the Europeans to see if the sanctity of the deal can be remained. And more importantly, I think the Europeans are going to be looking to the Iranians to see if there's any way to get Iran to revert back to its behavior under the JCPOA to be in accord with the deal. The fact that the United States is down the door, I think, is important because it's going to be observing this. It's going to be trying to weigh in when possible in an informal manner. But as we've noticed, from other experiences, the United States' buy-in is quite important. So I don't think this is going to be a high stakes or major set of discussions, but I think it sets an important path for what could happen to revert back to the JCPOA or some other new form of nuclear deal between the P5+1 and Iran.
So if those are the stakes, then what about the expectations for outcomes?
I mean, I think our expectations should be one of, identifying pathways where there are opportunities to cooperate and see where the JCPOA could still stand. I think we're going to be looking to what the deviations have been from the Iranians over the past 6 to 8 months, even longer. And then I think from the Iranian perspective, they're probably really trying to gauge what the likelihood of a long-term deal is. In the event that another administration comes into office in 2024, if they reach a deal right now, is that going to be abrogated in that timeline? So I think it's mostly just sort of gauging people's sense of what the likelihood of both reverting to a non-nuclear status or a more controlled nuclear status and what the longevity of a potential agreement could look like.
We've talked about the United States, Iran, and the other 2015 signatories to the JCPOA. But if we step back, there are other countries in the region who have voiced concern about the Iran nuclear deal. What are the implications for them that this discussion is underway?
Yeah, I mean, this is a tough question, in part because the Iran deal in specific, but also the negotiations leading up to it, really were trying to differentiate between the nuclear issue and some of the other broader regional issues. And certainly, that deal wasn't perfect. No deal is likely to be because it can't really address everything. But I think in terms of the sort of overarching regional or even overarching sort of relationship between the United States and Iran, I think the goal would be to see, again, what avenues there are for returning to the negotiation table for cooperation on this issue. And if there's a way to, in the process of doing that, also have conversations that would address some of the other concerns, support for non-state actors, proxy wars in other areas. You know, if that's something that can be done along the way, I think that would be great. It seems like President Biden's focus is first dealing with the nuclear issue and then seeing how that could open up opportunities for other forms of discussion. I'm cautiously optimistic. I'm a big fan of negotiations and discussions. I think that they're critical for helping to prevent nuclear proliferation, or at least stop it if it starts to occur. I think this is also going to set a really important stage for what happens with the United States and North Korea if they ever sit down at the table to talk about their nuclear program. So I'm cautiously optimistic, but again, this is a low-stakes set of discussions, so we'll just have to see how it goes.
Rupal Mehta teaches political science at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Minneapolis Police Chief Madaria Arredondo testified Monday that former police officer Derek Chauvin did not follow his police department's policy when he pinned George Floyd to the street by kneeling on his neck for more than 9 minutes. Police Chief Arredondo explains.
Once Mr. Floyd had stopped resisting, and certainly once he was in distress and trying to verbalize that, that should have stopped. There's an initial reasonableness in trying to just get him under control in the first few seconds, but once there was no longer any resistance, and clearly when Mr. Floyd was no longer responsive and even motionless, to continue to apply that level of force to a person proned out, handcuffed behind their back, that in no way, shape, or form is anything that is by policy. It is not part of our training, and it is certainly not part of our ethics or our values.
The jury also heard testimony from the emergency room doctor who pronounced Floyd dead. The AP's Ed Donahue has that part of the story.
Dr. Bradford Langenfeld testified he theorized the cause of death was asphyxiation.
That was one of the more likely possibilities. I felt that at the time, based on the information I had, it was more likely than the other possibilities.
Tape from Court TV. Prosecutors are trying to establish it was Derek Chauvin's knee on George Floyd's neck that killed him. Defense attorney Eric Nelson asked if there are other issues that could still lead to asphyxiation.
Drug use. Certain drugs can cause hypoxia. Agreed? Yes. Specifically fentanyl.
That's correct.
The defense argues Chauvin did what he was trained to do, and Floyd's use of illegal drugs and his underlying health conditions caused his death. I'm Ed Donahue.
India's health ministry says that it has recorded an all-time high of 103,558 new coronavirus cases, the highest daily tally this year in the South Asian nation. Mumbai, India's financial capital and the capital of Maharashtra state, is now under stringent lockdown measures. About half of the country's new coronavirus cases were recorded in that state. Only two nations have more confirmed cases than India, the United States and Brazil. Elsewhere, millions of people worldwide were under new lockdown restrictions during the Easter weekend because of infections that have surged despite the continued rollout of vaccination campaigns. And a new study finds that stillbirths, ectopic pregnancies, and maternal deaths increased during the pandemic, possibly because women had reduced access to medical services. Mariama Diallo takes it from here.
Little Malek was born at the beginning of March. His mother, Hind Shurgen, found out she was pregnant during the coronavirus pandemic. She was told to minimize trips to doctors or hospitals where services were stretched by the number of patients with the virus. Eventually, she fell sick and was diagnosed remotely with pneumonia. But after her illness, her doctor did an antigen test that confirmed she's had COVID-19.
It's just a huge, you know, world that's really unknown. And it really pushed me over the edge. And I was so stressed out throughout the whole end of my pregnancy because of that. You know, what if, what if, what if?
After several scans, Shurgen was assured her baby was developing normally, but she couldn't stop worrying.
You're kind of, you know, playing a lottery with this information. I didn't get tested again for antigens, but I did carry out the fear with me and this worry and constant, like second guessing everything I did.
Professor Asma Khalil, an obstetrician at St. George's Hospital in London, is among a group of doctors studying the impact of the virus on women and their pregnancies.
We included more than 6 million pregnant women from 40 studies from 17 countries. And we compared the pregnancy outcomes during the COVID-19 pandemic with the period before the pandemic.
The report published in the Lancet Medical Journal found that the number of stillbirths and the number of women who died during pregnancy rose by nearly a third during the pandemic. The number of women who needed emergency care for ectopic pregnancies, where the fetus is growing outside of the womb, was 6 times higher in 2020 than the year before. Also in the report, a significant increase in the number of women suffering stress and anxiety. Khalil says stillbirths and deaths are not a direct cause of infection from COVID-19, but from what she describes as collateral damage of the pandemic. Across the world, lockdowns prevented women from traveling to hospitals for checkups. Co-author of the Lancet report, Professor Shakila Tangaratnam from the University of Birmingham, advises some caution over the data.
If you look at stillbirths, the figures are a bit more, but because of the rarity of the condition of stillbirths, the proportion itself is still quite low. We are talking about number of stillbirths around 1,000 in high-income settings and another 1,000 in a low-income setting. And again, this is something that will need to be reviewed constantly.
She says there is no doubt the pandemic has had an adverse influence on women's health, but many more studies need to be done.
How much it is, how generalizable this is across countries as well as across the income status, what are the specific factors that contribute most? So these are information that we still need to continue to report and collect.
Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Floods and landslides triggered by tropical cyclone Seroja in a cluster of islands in southeast Indonesia and East Timor have killed at least 130 people, with many still unaccounted for and thousands displaced. Rescuers are being hampered by damaged bridges and roads, as well as a lack of heavy equipment. In Nigeria, authorities say more than 1,800 inmates have escaped after a heavily armed gang attacked a prison in the southern part of the country using explosives on Monday. It is one of the West African country's largest prison breaks. No group has claimed responsibility. A Swiss startup is looking to boost confidence in the safety of air travel amid the coronavirus pandemic by using decades-old technology. VOA's Arash Arabasadi shines a light on this story.
A virus-killing robot roams the aisles of an airplane in Zurich. The robot must operate without a human to deliver its waves of ultraviolet light. UVA co-founder Jodak Elmazur explains.
It's quite an old technology, but it's quite dangerous. That's why we want to take the worker out of the range of the light. So that's why we made a robot.
Excess exposure to ultraviolet or UV radiation can cause cancers in humans. But UVA's founders say the decades-old UVC technology delivered by the autonomous robot has the upside of killing the coronavirus. Elmazur says using light to sanitize a plane is safer than cleaning solutions.
UVC doesn't make any traces or chemistry, so that's also very important for the traveler, that you know that you have a safe place and there is no chemical residue on the seats or everywhere.
One robot can disinfect an entire single-aisle airplane in 13 minutes. That's welcome news for Swiss regional airline Helvetic Airways, says spokesman Matti Gönen.
As an airline, at the moment, it's really important that we can restore the confidence in air travel. So if our passengers, if our crew know our aircraft is safe, there is no viruses, no bacteria, it could help to fly again and to have a good feeling to fly again.
The U.S. Food and Drug Administration says UVC radiation is a known disinfectant for air, water, and non-porous surfaces, but can be blocked by something as simple as dust. UVA currently has 3 robot prototypes and recently demonstrated one of them at the Zurich airport, where traffic dropped 75% last year. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
And finally, bamboo bicycles in Ghana are generating a lot of interest in the international market. Boomers International, a grassroots community development organization, specializes in producing bamboo-framed bicycles for export worldwide. For more, Africa 54's Paul Ndiho spoke with Wabena Danso, the company's CEO, via Skype.
You are everywhere. Boomers International is booming. Tell me more about it, my friend.
When you came to do the interview, we had started working on our expansion plan. We were looking at how we increase our production and also expand our market. We've had a number of expansions, including even expanding our product portfolio. So when you were here, we were only doing the normal bikes and then the children tricycles, I think. But now we've also started producing electric bikes. And so we keep on developing new products, we keep on coming up with. And we were only limited in Europe through our partners called Maibu. But now we are also hitting the North American market. We've hit the North American market very well, and we are still working to get more shops and more partners to work with in North America. I think we've sold almost about 50 bikes in North America right now.
Interesting. Why would one want to buy your bike as opposed to the regular bikes that we see in the stores?
The bamboo bike is environmentally friendly. It's being made from wood. There's nothing like rusting on the frame. So the frame doesn't rust, it's environmentally sustainable. And because we are promoting the use of bamboo, we are also supporting the growing and the planting of bamboo, and bamboo actually absorbs more carbon than any other plant. And so once we are promoting the use of bamboo and the growing of bamboo, we are actually promoting environmental sustainability within the communities where we work. It gives the rider so much ride that the person feels very comfortable on the bike because it absorbs the shocks, the bumps very well. Though our electric bikes can be heavier because of the motors we put them on and other things, that is heavier. But for the normal bikes, they are comparable to aluminum bikes. The other aspect of our why people like is our social impact. We train young people in the rural areas, and then with the skills, and then we employ them at a factory. So currently we have about 40 young people who are directly employed at the factory.
The last time we talked, you talked about a project. It was one of your dreams. And I've since learned that you've built a school where you're helping kids in the community. Can you speak to that?
One of my goals is how do we train the next generation of African leaders, young people, to think differently, to think proactively, to become change makers, become ethical leaders, and to pioneer the development Africa needs and what Africa wants. And so the whole idea of the school is about change making. So currently what we're trying to provide is a world-class education, using world-class pedagogy to train these children with a different state of thinking. We currently have about 370 kids between the ages of 2 and 10 years who are undergoing such training programs through our school. So it's been an exciting program. It's been a very exciting journey. I go to the school every day feeling so proud, feeling so happy because we see the change that is coming.
How much of an impact has COVID-19 had on those projects?
Because of COVID-19, all schools were closed down for about 8 months. And so it affected the kids much in terms of academic work, in terms of training, in terms of development. But for boomers, we didn't really feel the COVID. Actually, because of COVID, a lot of people are now practicing social distancing. And so people are now more interested in bicycles. And because people are now more interested in bicycles, we have actually an upsurge in production. And so we are actually increasing our production to make sure we meet the growing demand. And the only way we had a problem was with the shipment. when we were shipping the bikes to customers. Because of COVID, there were delays in shipping. Sometimes you can't even get a courier to ship the goods, and it was hectic.
Kwabena, thank you so much for your time, man.
Thank you so much, Paul.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by visiting voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.